for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Gunmen seize hostages in a hotel in Mali, reportedly killing three. French and Belgian governments push for strengthened counterterrorism measures following the attacks in Paris. And Russia confirms a bomb brought down the civilian airliner over Egypt. Joining me for the International Hour, the Friday News Roundup, Yoki Driessen of Foreign Policy, Shane Harris with The Daily Beast, and Ed Luce at the Financial Times. You're always invited to be part of the program. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Thank you all for being here.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
Good to have you all here. What do we know about this attack in Mali? It would seem that the hostages are out, but what do we know about who did this and why?
In terms of who did it, unfortunately, with Mali, you can take, it's almost like a deck of cards and pull out any one of them, and they're all very likely. There is an Islamic State affiliate that is believed to be operating in and near Mali. But remember also, Mali was where Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, that's where they conquered the north of Mali and held it for months. This was prior to the Islamic State capturing parts of Iraq and Syria. This was the first time a terror group conquered and governed territory. I spent a month there for The Atlantic, and they had built a government. They had taxes. They had a post office, a postal system. The French went in. They were bombing. They had different African nations sending ground forces to evict them from the north. But they've been coming back steadily. They've been killing African peacekeepers. They've been mounting attacks in and around Bamako. Sèvres, another major city, had a hotel siege where several people died. So you have the Islamic State potential. You have the Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb potential. You have some offshoot group that have been operating in the north as a potential. The one thing we do know is, timing-wise, whoever it is, it's not coincidence. If this was not the Islamic State, they want to have the same press the Islamic State is getting.
And, Shane, are they after the French? Are they basically targeting the French?
I think that's the first thing that comes to mind, as Yoki was saying. I mean, the French have been there and have had a military presence there as well. This feels very opportunistic. It looks that way, following on the Paris attacks. If this is ISIS or an affiliate, a demonstration of saying, we can hit you here, too, and make you pay. But it was also a hotel frequented by Westerners. There were Americans in the hotel. There were Germans. The U.S. Embassy is not far from that hotel, and American Special Forces did respond to that attack. So it could also be aimed broadly at the West, even though there's more of a French nexus there.
And now, apparently, Ed, all the hostages are out.
Yes, they're all out. The raid, the joint U.S.-French raid was successful. And there were only three deaths. I mean, only, I say, obviously three too many, but it was a relatively low casualty by the standards of some of these recent hostage situations. I think it's worth noting that there have been two horrific suicide attacks in northern Nigeria in the last few days by very young girls, a 13-year-old girl in one attack and as young as 11 in another, and that have taken 45 lives, 46 lives, and this is Boko Haram, you know, who have switched their franchise from Al-Qaeda to ISIS, and there are also Boko Haram elements in northern Mali. So this is, sort of adds to Yoki and Shane's points about the whole confusion and menage of different groups trying to exploit the publicity following the Paris attacks.
And how much do we truly know about the Paris attack?
Well, a frighteningly large new amount with every single passing day, it seems. I mean, the fact that the French believed that Aboud was in Syria until as recently as Monday, you know, hadn't been aware of the fact that he'd been toing and froing from Syria is deeply alarming, I think. So the more we learn, the more we realize we should have known.
and bragging about the fact wherever he was that he was free to move back and forth, Shane.
That's right. I mean, it was a very useful propaganda tool, I think, at the time to say he could kind of move back and forth like this. But we have to take that very seriously because it appears he was correct. He has ties to people in Syria who are known ISIS fighters who've actually been targeted in French airstrikes as recently as 5 or 6 weeks ago. So this is an individual who, it appears, did have real freedom of movement and is being described as sort of the operational kind of ringleader of these attacks. He's also been linked to 4 of 6 other thwarted attacks, French officials are now saying. So a very, very active person, probably in touch with multiple cells. I think this really points to what is clearly a major intelligence and security failure here in France and in Belgium as well, that they did not have eyes on this guy as he was moving back and forth.
However, didn't I understand that U.S. intelligence had warned the French earlier this year that something was to be expected?
I mean, I think there was a lot of chatter. I think there are two issues. One that really matters. The number of people that France has on its official watch lists, depending on the numbers they put out, one is 11,500, one is 8,000. They just don't have the resources to do it because each one requires personnel, requires money, requires analysts on the other end, so that if they're eavesdropping to someone speaking, let's say, in Arabic or in any of the dialects of Africa, to translate it. And France doesn't have the infrastructure to do it. There is a major, major intelligence failure, without question, that we can say has already happened, which is the conventional wisdom for quite a while, up until the Russia attack, was Al-Qaeda was focused on attacks in other countries, ISIS was focused on controlling territory and wasn't focused on attacks in other countries. And that's now been proven tragically wrong, first with the Russian attack, now with the attacks in Paris, possibly the attacks in Beirut as well. So the intel analysis on the macro level that Al-Qaeda and ISIS were fundamentally different, without question, we could say that was completely, entirely wrong.
I would think that certainly American citizens would be hugely disappointed considering all the money that's gone into U.S. intelligence.
Yeah, more than $50 billion by the latest figure that was released about 4 weeks ago, and that's just the national, non-military, unclassified portion of that budget. And this raises significant concerns about how well do we understand the nature of these transnational, cross-border ambitions of ISIS. We saw them making threats about attacks in Washington and New York this week. If there's anything that we should really take away from this latest week, it's that when ISIS says it's going to do something, believe that that is exactly what they're trying to do. And to Yochi's point, we can no longer just assume that this is a group that is going to restrain its ambitions to building territory in Iraq and Syria and not take the fight elsewhere.
Do you believe that the threats against Washington and New York are authentic?
I think they're credible insofar as I think that's what ISIS would like to do. I think they would have a harder time launching those attacks in the United States because I think that we do have probably better security measures in place. That does not mean it's not possible. It's not low risk. And I don't think they would have any trouble finding guns in this country and the things that they would need to do those attacks. They hit incredibly soft targets. They would be the equivalent. The Paris attack, someone had described it as, you know, going through neighborhoods in Brooklyn, you know, sort of like young, hip neighborhoods where people are hanging out. They're enjoying their time outside. They're going to clubs. We have ample numbers of targets like that in the United States and not just in New York and in Washington.
Well, I think it's worth mentioning, it might be slightly overlooked at the moment, that Belgium has the laxest gun laws in Europe. The homicide rate from gunfire, from firearms in Belgium is 7 times what it is in Britain, which has one of the strictest. And that a lot of these operations have involved the Belgium arms market. The foiled attack on the high-speed train earlier this year, the attacker was believed to have purchased arms there. Several of these attackers are believed to have got their equipment, their explosive, their arms from Belgium. And I think this is going to become a much larger, if you listen to the tone of irritation from French officials about not just Belgian lapses in intelligence, but Belgian lapses in terms of monitoring arms sales. That's going to become a bigger factor in the days ahead.
And what about implementing new and tougher security measures in France, Yochi? How far will that go?
You know, France, when we think of the creation of the EU, it was basically France and Germany that created it, and one of the things that those involved are most proud of was the Schengen. I mean, it's a weird name and a weird word that doesn't ring right to American ears.
How do you spell it?
S-C-S-C-H-E-N-G-E-N. Yay, winning the spelling bee. But they're proud of the fact that after millennia of war, where borders were always seen for decades in the 20th century as a place where if you got to the border, maybe you got further, maybe you didn't, that you had border-free travel, that a passport, once you were in the EU, you can go anywhere. And that was something they were proud of, that it was a historic accomplishment. And you're seeing that fall away, day by day, week by week. And every attack that happens, every attack that's foiled, the likelihood of it permanently falling away gets larger and larger. Already today, you have the French say that they want to have a much stricter passport control system, even just within France, that somebody crossing into French territory has to show their passport where they didn't have to show it before the attack. They want much greater powers for the French president. They want much greater surveillance powers. They want the ability to search houses without warrants, the ability to detain suspects without warrants. So you're seeing just a massive law enforcement change, and then also a massive pivot away from the values the EU had prided itself on for decades.
And, of course, French police now being able to carry guns. But, you know, it worries me about those passports, considering the number of fake passports that are out there. We're going to take a short break here, and when we come back, we'll talk further about what's happening in our world. Stay with us.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And welcome back to the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup this week with Shane Harris. He's senior correspondent with the Daily Beast and author of At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. Yoki Driessen is managing editor of Foreign Policy. He's the author of the book The Invisible Front, and Ed Luce is chief U.S. columnist and commentator for the Financial Times. His book is titled Time to Start Thinking, America and the Specter of Decline. Here's an email from Anastasia. She says, though I'm a lifelong Francophile who grieves for the lives lost in the attacks in Paris, I think it's important to place equal emphasis on the many Muslim lives lost in attacks in other parts of the world, such as the suicide bombings in Nigeria. Muslim lives matter, too. And the problem is that Muslims are finding themselves carried under this blanket term that somehow people are assigning barbarism to all Muslims.
Yeah, I mean, 97% of the victims of terror, I mean, the number varies a little bit, but the most plausible database, 97% of victims of terrorism are Muslim. People worldwide are Muslim, and we forget that the numbers you see in Syria, in Iraq, in Algeria, in Nigeria, every week match or dwarf what we've seen in Paris in the last week. And yet, of course, our response to it is, because it's so much closer to home, is disproportionate to the numbers and to the risk. Compared to what Muslims around the world face. So I think the danger in a situation like this is we reinforce the whole narrative that they don't matter.
Do you see here in this country, as we were talking about, in the last hour, governors in 31 states now saying they will refuse to accept any migrants. Now, how you keep people out when they simply have visas to come here, who may have stolen passports, who may have forged identification. I mean, how do you do that?
Well, there's a system in place that is supposed to try and catch at least the fake and stolen passports. Any people who are traveling to the United States, we screen their passports against an Interpol database that checks for these kinds of things. You might not be able to catch everyone. I think what was very interesting in this debate among the governors was this presumption that the governors have some authority to seal borders in this country. They do not. It is a federal issue, and I think this is to a large extent was, you know, an expression of, you know, many emotions, but probably, but it's politically untenable.
At the same time, what they can do and are doing is denying funds to support those refugees, so they may have to go elsewhere. So how about information sharing? How about intelligence sharing? You all have said that the intelligence here really, really fell down. What more can be done in that regard, Yoki?
There needs to be a lot more money. I mean, we know, roughly speaking, what the U.S. spends. You know, Shane pointed out that the $50 billion figure is non-military and it's the unclassified. Add in the military and the classified, it's doubtlessly much, much higher. France and England have both announced plans to hire, in the case of England, it was 1,900. I don't know the number for France, but significant numbers of new analysts, new spies, covert, new, especially new people who are better at surveillance using technological surveillance, people who can eavesdrop, whether it's phone, whether it's email, whether it's web traffic, whether it's the dark web that is being used, sort of sophisticated encryption technology that's being used to communicate. There's an ongoing debate here about between Silicon Valley and the government about if Apple is building in really good encryption that the government can't break, can Apple be forced to allow the government in? That debate's been going on for a long time. You now have people basically saying, and I think in the case of John McCain, almost verbatim saying, these companies will have blood on their hands because they're refusing to allow the government to have a backdoor into their systems. It's an interesting point. Just one other thing very quickly. We're in this crazy election season where people say things that are kind of easy to laugh at, shake our head, and move on. But we should call what we're hearing now in this country what it is, and it is bigotry. When you have Donald Trump, and we were talking about this in my office this morning, and I recognize that as a Jewish American, this may hit me in a somewhat different way than it might hit some others. But when you have a major presidential candidate leading in the polls talking about registering Muslims based on their religion, talking about giving them special ID cards, I mean, this is sickening. I mean,
Nazi,
this is something.
Germany.
This is really bigotry, and it's very scary to me.
Yeah, and I'll pick up on the intelligence sharing point in a second, but just to follow on from what Yoki's saying, I don't think people hearing this news of 31 governors denying access to Syrian refugees will know that they don't have the full authority to carry that out. I think this will just be more than half of America said no to Syrian refugees, Muslim databases, and the damage in terms of winning the hearts and minds side of this, which is where it really matters, in the Middle East and elsewhere, is incalculable. It's not just a bigotry question here on the ground in America. It's about America's effectiveness in terms of fighting the war of hearts and minds. But the intelligence sharing proposals France came up with after the Charlie Hebdo massacre in January were very concrete. They were stuff you would have thought would have been in place already in terms of information sharing between airlines, border posts, Interpol databases that were either not there or were very incompletely in place. And nothing was done. Nothing was done. So between January and...
What should have been done?
Well, money is one thing. To get all the border posts... I mean, there's a whole sort of series of Greek border posts. And you imagine the Greeks aren't going to come up with the money on their own. They're going to need EU money to do this. And they don't have the computer system. They don't have the databases as a matter of routine. Many of the posts don't have access to that information. This is the first port of call for most of the refugees coming across by water. So it's not just a sieve. This is a gaping hole. But that does require money. Athens isn't going to come up with it. It requires Brussels, Germany, and others to come up with it. And this was very clearly understood and agreed to by the EU in January. Nothing was done.
There's one other point on this, too. We're talking a lot about technological surveillance, and it is the case that ISIS fighters, and maybe even in this instance, are using commercially available encrypted communications that makes it exceptionally difficult for even very expensive and robust systems like ours to find them. There's another argument here of what is needed, which is more human intelligence, which is more people being able to infiltrate into these networks, report back what's going on from the ground. One of the better sources of information about ISIS has been freed hostages from ISIS, who can talk a lot about where they've been moving, how they move people. We captured the wife of a main ISIS logistics man in a raid some months ago. She provided an extraordinary amount of information. There needs to be an investment in classic old-fashioned spying as well.
And what about Russia, Yogi? How much will Russia's cooperation with France and the U.S. make a difference?
What will be interesting to see is whether the Russian airstrikes begin to shift in a noticeable way from what they had been, which was under the guise of bombing ISIS, actually bombing the guys we had armed, trained
exactly.
to try to fight Assad. The Pentagon is now admitting that they are seeing a shift where, although the strikes are not really being coordinated with the U.S. in any functional or substantive way, they are seeing more strikes hit Islamic State targets as compared to rebel targets.
And that's because the Russians learned the bomb
exactly.
was on board.
Exactly. And in the immediate aftermath of the attack, it was very interesting that Vladimir Putin, hawk of hawks, chest-pounding macho guy, it took him a while to acknowledge that this had been a bomb. For days, he was saying, no, this was Metrojet, this was an engine, this was something other than a bomb, which surprised me, because normally this is a man who loves to use military force, who loves to be a sort of martial leader. Now that he has acknowledged it's a bomb, you're seeing the tempo of Russian airstrikes escalate. You're seeing the number of them that are hitting Islamic State areas escalate. I mean, one number that was fascinating, it came up at a congressional hearing last week. They were asking the Pentagon how many U.S. airstrikes had there been that month. It was about 100. And they asked, it was 8 to 1. I'm forgetting now if it was 100 to 800 or if it was 1,000 to 8,000. But it was 8 to 1 Russian to U.S. So that ratio is astounding. And you will see, without question, the Russian numbers go even higher.
Vladimir Putin is also using this as an opportunity to demonstrate his military capability to the world. So this week, there was a sortie of 25 long-range Russian bombers that went against Raqqa. That is one of the biggest military flights in recent modern history. It is extraordinary that he sent that many planes in. So it's not just about attacking ISIS and some of these other groups and trying to prop up Assad. Putin is using this as a demonstration of his global military reach as well.
It's interesting. François Hollande, France's president, is coming here to Washington, D.C. next week.
Yeah.
Exactly. Then he goes to Moscow. And we were talking earlier before the show that it's remarkable how many senior world leaders are beating a path to Moscow. It was a pariah a few months ago. Now it's Grand Central. And Putin, I think is playing this very, very well. How this pans out in terms of grand coalition potential and cooperation between Russia and the U.S. in terms of coordinated airstrikes and intelligence sharing, etc., is another question entirely. But the leverage is moving his way the whole time.
And just 2 years ago, it was as though he was irrelevant. And now he is building Russia up to be the major power he wants it to be.
Right, and you're seeing two things that are fascinating, kind of illustrate it. One, people vote with their feet, and as you watch world leaders, whether it is Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Quds Force, the most wanted anti-U.S. fighter in the world, go to Moscow. 2 weeks later, Bibi Netanyahu, dire blood enemy of Iran, go to Moscow. Now you're watching the Gulf states, who for decades have come to the U.S. for protection, they're going to Moscow. You're seeing the shift of interest and power go there.
Really interesting.
But the one win that Putin has had, which is unquestionable, Vladimir Putin years ago believed Bashar al-Assad should stay in power. The consensus in the West was he had to go. Now you're seeing leader after leader, politician after politician all say basically, in some cases explicitly, he can stay. He's not the focus right now. Hollande said kind of pro forma, yeah, Assad should go at some point, but then he said our enemy is Daesh, using a different name for the Islamic State. Hillary Clinton yesterday, giving a major foreign policy speech, again said the focus is the Islamic State. So what Putin has wanted for years, which is Assad to remain in power, to not be a pariah, he's won.
All right, let's go to Mimi in Bethesda, Maryland. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a quick question. But I just want to start out by saying I'm definitely all for taking refugees, particularly children and women, if they want to take a little longer to investigate other people coming in, that's fine. But why haven't I heard anything about United Arab Emirates or Yemen or Kuwait taking refugees? Is this a Shia Sunni issue, or right. Why aren't they being called on?
Shane.
There have been some calls on them, and I don't necessarily think that the numbers are that impressive of the people that they've been taking in. There has been, you know, obviously a large human exodus into Western Europe. I mean, people are making the choice to go there. But yes, there have been calls on those very governments to do more to support these people. There's obviously a huge number in Jordan. I think it's at least more than 1 million refugees. It's probably higher than that now. But there is a regional responsibility issue in play here, too, and that's something that the Obama administration and others have brought up.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Yogi, you were talking about the influence that Russia is currently playing. What is the possibility now that Russia is playing such a strong role for some kind of peace settlement in Syria?
I think you can envision a scenario in which Russia maintains the Assad regime, if not Bashar al-Assad, that they're able to say, we are transitioning the person, Bashar al-Assad, to a beautiful villa in Sochi, built from the Olympics, empty ever since. Bashar al-Assad, welcome to Sochi. But his regime staying, led perhaps by another member of the Assad family, led by someone who isn't a member of the Assad family but is in the Assad governmental structure. In other words, the exact opposite of what the U.S. did in Baghdad.
And so what does the U.S. do in the face of that kind of compromise?
Rhetoric aside, I think the U.S., if they felt as if the person taking power was not directly linked to some of the worst atrocities, and if they felt that that was a potential to a peace deal, rhetoric aside, that they would take it in a heartbeat.
And all of that because they don't want to see Syria broken up, Ed.
No, and there have been plans circulating. There have been ideas circulating along those lines. You know, I think the key question about Assad and whether it's enough to remove him or have a period of transition before he removed is whether Saudi Arabia agrees. And Saudi Arabia sets the line for the Gulf region. And if Saudi Arabia agrees that this is acceptable, then you might have a deal on your hands. But this has been apparent for quite some time that the only kind of settlement you're going to have is one where Saudi Arabia and Iran are going to sign up to it. And if Russia can bring along Iran and the West can bring along Saudi Arabia, then you have the building blocks for some kind of settlement.
How likely is that to come into being, Shane?
I think it's more likely than it was a week ago before the Paris attacks. I mean, I think that there's something driving people together, however tentatively and furtively, towards some kind of, I hesitate to use the word coalition, but some sort of agreed upon settlement where it's going to be a compromise. Not everyone is going to get everything that they want.
And should Syria be settled, should there be a compromise put in place, how might that affect the activities of ISIS, Yogi?
I think if there is a settlement, part of it would have to be that the countries around Syria, whether it's Iraq, whether it's Jordan, whether it's Turkey, whether it's the Gulf states, that they then focus all of their forces, militarily, financially, and otherwise, on battering ISIS. I think basically what you'd be trading is a bloody regime, a regime that has done horrific, horrific atrocities, trading that regime staying in power for the effort to destroy ISIS. I mean, that would be, Shane's exactly right, that it would be a compromise people wouldn't love, in part because you'd be accepting the continuation of a bloody regime because you believe ISIS is a more dangerous threat.
And is it also because, looking back, having removed Gaddafi and Mubarak, we realize what mistakes those were, Ed?
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. It's certainly been governing Hillary Clinton's response. Her speech on Thursday at the Council on Foreign Relations showed a sort of modesty, I think, that she might not have had in this situation had Libya, had the chaos in Libya not happened. But the, you know, I think the key thing with the Syria stability is to get the Sunni population feeling more secure. And until they do, ISIS is going to continue to have an open field.
And we'll take a short break here. When we come back, more of your calls, comments. Stay with us. And welcome back. Time to go back to the phones. 800-433-8850 to Haverhill, Massachusetts. Richard, you're on the air.
Thanks very much, Diane. Saudi Arabia and Turkey, their hatred for Assad, they're responsible for a lot of what's gone on in both countries, well, particularly Saudi Arabia and both Iraq and Syria. Saudi Arabia has supported al-Qaeda and ISIS with arms and money. And Turkey, they're so involved in worrying about the Kurds and letting, also they let so many, they never blocked off their borders. They let so many volunteers go into Syria to fight for ISIS and al-Qaeda in the Nusra Front. So, and, you know, it just doesn't seem to any end to this Sunni Shia divide, Diane. I don't know when it's going to end, but they just hate each other so much.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're getting exactly to the factionalism, the regionalism, the complexity of all of this. And I mean, you know, I think the Obama administration, to some degree, would be agreeing with the caller right now. The extent to which you see this president being extremely reluctant to try and use U.S. force to try and influence events in this region, which I think he rightly believes are simply more complicated than a problem for us to solve, certainly not unilaterally. This is going to have to be a long-term regional solution. And I mean, and we talked about where does this end. I wish I knew, but I think the ending comes from some place in that region, this part of the world, these people having to settle this. It's just it's terribly vexing, but it's not something that we're going to wave a wand and solve.
All right, to Josh in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Surely.
So I wanted to clarify two issues with the idea of an encryption backdoor. The first issue is you cannot create a government backdoor into an encryption algorithm without making it irreparably insecure to hackers. So if we create a backdoor for the government to get in, it also makes that encryption vulnerable to people that would want to steal, for example, credit card information. The other issue is the issue of trust. I think we've seen very clearly with the NSA bulk surveillance program that the intelligence agencies can't necessarily be trusted to act constitutionally and get warrants for surveillance. So I don't think it would be wise for companies to add a government backdoor and trust the intelligence community to use that in a way that's lawful.
I think that the caller makes a very good point, but the politics is going to push more and more on this as time goes on. It's interesting, Europe had a ruling recently that the safe harbor agreement that the US and Europe had what wasn't working because of what Edward Snowden had revealed, and that they're both now renegotiating this. But it's worth pointing out that European individual countries have far more intrusive surveillance systems than the United States does, mm-hmm. and far fewer legal protections. So there is a element of double standard here. And I think the encryption debate is not one that would be happening in Europe, most of Europe right now, Germany being a very big exception.
Shame.
The issue of trust, and the caller's right, by the way, on the technological aspects of you can't build a backdoor that only the government can get into.
Right.
There's a lack of trust on the part of technology companies towards government in the wake of the revelations from Edward Snowden. In an ideal world, the government would have partners that it felt it could work with in times of crisis and get access to communications. That's to some degree how things have worked in the past. We are not there because of this breakdown in trust. You're seeing the companies proactively implement this encryption. The government has a lot of work to do in repairing that breach of trust with those companies and is trying very hard to do that right now.
Here's an email from Jules who says, please talk about the social and economic conditions of Muslims in France. Don't these conditions contribute to disaffection and recruitment of youth to become foreign fighters as much as any factors. Yogi.
It is accurate, and there has been conventional wisdom for quite some time that in some of the Muslim communities that are around Paris that tourists would never go to because they're hideous blocks of skyscrapers, that you have immigrants from North Africa, whether it's Tunisians, Algerians, people who had a history of coming to France because of the connections with former colonies, that because unemployment there is so high, you had rioting when President Sarkozy was in power, and he derisively referred to those areas in a way that was widely seen as derogatory towards Muslims. And so there has been a feeling that those particular areas on the outskirts of Paris are worrisome, that they are places where France has not integrated those communities and where there is violence. That said, the conventional wisdom about individual terrorists is often wrong. The ringleaders of these cases were Moroccan. They were relatively well-adjusted. They were relatively well-educated. They came from not wealthy families, but not impoverished ones. It was very interesting. A story ran in the last day or so that the family of the suspected ringleader had hoped for his death, that when they had gotten word some years ago that he was dead, the family said, thank God, because he is going to bring shame to our family. He's going to do something bad. He at one point brought his younger brother, who was just 13, with him to Syria. So the parents of the family, the parents in this family and his siblings were horrified by what he'd become. But the conventional wisdom that terrorists are poor, uneducated, taken advantage of, in this case was completely factually wrong.
And it hasn't been true all along. If you think of the 9/11 attackers, these are people with degrees, some of them had doctorates. And if you look at the London underground attacks in 2004, these were British Muslims. Some of them were employed. If you look at the attempted attacks, with mixing liquids on transatlantic flights 3-4 years later, the group that was arrested there were employed people. Some of them, again, were graduates. So I think the tendency to boil it down to economics is too narrow. This is a social question more broadly. It mixes with the economics, but it's a lot more complex.
All right. To Miami, Florida. Tarasik, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, hello. Diane, Nazreem, it's me, Tarasik. You can call me Taras for short.
All right.
Yeah, I happen to be an American of Arab descent, Palestinian-American, and my take, or rather my suggestion on the Syrian slash Iraqi refugee crisis is that I believe that I think that the humanist solution for dealing with the refugee problem from Syria and Iraq is setting up, having the international community come together with the participation of the United States, of course, setting up some kind of UN-mandated processing camp for these refugees, maybe in the United States or in some neutral geographic location where it wouldn't be like an internment camp or a concentration camp at all, but just a processing camp where these people can be cordoned off from the war zone and be in some stable place and where they can be processed and where participating countries willing to accept Syrian and Iraqi refugees can take in these countries, and that processing center would be a locale where these refugees could be processed and then be sent.
All right. Thanks for your call, Shane.
Well, many of the refugees are already in camps. They're enormous. There are millions and millions of people who've been displaced. The question is, where are they going to go back to? They presumably would like to go back to their homes in Syria, what may be left of them. I don't think it's quite. I get where the caller is coming from.
But many would like to come here.
This isn't just simply a logistics problem. You're talking about a massive displacement of humanity, unlike anything that has been seen in recent human history.
Exactly. Ed.
Well, somebody asked earlier why the Saudis and the Emiratis were taking so few refugees. I don't think any refugees particularly want to go there. If you look at where they're voting with their feet and across the water, it's Europe, and it would be the United States if it was more easily accessible. So that's clearly the situation. Right now, Angela Merkel, the Germany's chancellor, is dealing with very strong requests from President Erdogan of Turkey, to pay the Turks more money to treat the 2.2 million Syrian refugees on Turkish soil better, to give them some rights. There's a talk of €3 billion package. The quid pro quo that the Turks want is a visa waiver for Turks to go to Europe, which I think is was politically very difficult a week ago, is now inconceivable.
And what is Hillary saying about refugees coming here to the U.S., Yoki?
She's basically using it as a chance to bash Republicans. She's saying that we can and should do more, that the numbers we are allowing in are too low, and frankly they are, they're pitiful. The idea that we are taking in 10,000 to 17,000 in total, while Germany is taking in 800,000 in a year,
but then
is
she's
staggering.
Distancing herself from President Obama.
Yeah, she's trying to distance herself from him on all things Syria related. To say, if we had armed them earlier, like Hillary Clinton suggested when I was still in office, maybe it would be different. If we set up a no-fly zone, like I've been saying for 6 months, maybe things would be different. If we didn't use words like contained, maybe things would be different. She's trying as much as she can to distance him on all things about the Islamic State, believing, I think, correctly that politically no one is looking at President Obama's handling of this and thinking, yeah, that's pretty good. Let's keep going what he's doing.
All right. To Yellow Springs, Ohio. Henry, you're on the air.
Yes, please. You comment that Russia, you know, is doing 10 times more bombing than we are and everything. But looking at the last 15 years, we have rather a dismal record of killing civilians in our bombings and our firings and attacks and everything. And so, of course, we want to be very, very cautious, whereas Russia, they're new boys on the block and the cruise missiles, you know. You know, no one said how many civilian casualties were there. So I think there's, you know, you have to let up a little bit on how cautious we are.
All right.
I have to jump in here and say Chechen. Now, Chechen, you know, might not technically be outside of Russia's borders, but the brutality with which Vladimir Putin basically razed that country, that territory to the ground in order to stamp out the separatist rebellion there, it is something that no United States action or misguided, you know, attack in Afghanistan could come anywhere close to. It's sort of stands out as one of the most brutal interventions by a country. So I don't think they're the new kids on the block in this game.
And do we have any idea what's happening currently with Ukraine, which seems to have moved completely off at least the media landscape?
I think if you're the government of Ukraine, you are crying into whatever alcoholic drink you have closest to you, because whatever small amount of pressure the West is willing to exert on Vladimir Putin to stop meddling in eastern Ukraine or to give back Crimea, that's gone. And that's gone forever. I think you can officially...
Gone forever, you believe.
Forever may be overstating it, but I can't imagine any time in the next few years. I mean, the fight against ISIS, this is going to take a long, long time.
Yeah.
And as long as that fight is going, as long as there's a belief that Russia could help prevent terrorists from crossing into the U.S. or Europe, no one is going to care about the Ukraine.
Do you agree, Shane?
I think that's fundamentally right. And you can see the reporting from monitors there on the border day in, day out, that there are convoys going back and forth. It's sort of business as usual, frankly, of how it was back when we were more concerned about this before events in the Middle East came to dominate the stage. But, you know, if the price that we ultimately have to pay for bringing Vladimir Putin into some kind of alignment that we fight ISIS together is we sort of agree to look the other way on Ukraine, I think we're going to pay it.
It's just worth mentioning, though, I agree more broadly with what you've both said, but it's worth mentioning the EU is set to renew sanctions on Russia. The defense and energy and, in regard to Ukraine. And there's pretty much consensus on that. So, you know, it might not be pushing hard on him, but it's not dismantling what's already in place.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And to Elizabeth in St. Louis, Missouri, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I'm 87 years old. One brother was killed and one was crippled in the Second World War. And I keep hoping that the world's going to achieve peace. There seemed on the Internet such an intense desire for people to reach out to each other, to know more about each other. How can we bring some stronger emphasis on this side of the human spirit?
But you have so much nationalism going on at precisely the same time. It's as though all of the connection that the Internet has created has not just a positive side, but a negative side as well, Yogi.
And not just nationalism. I mean, this is, if we're looking at the violence in Israel and Palestine, a lot of the videos that are being shared, these are social media videos. These are being videos that are either posted to Facebook of stabbings, of the aftermath of shootings. If we look at the radicalization of Muslims across the country, in the U.S., some of the attacks that are taking place here, the Nidal Hassan attack near Fort Hood, these are people who made the connection with the people who radicalized them over the internet. And, the caller, and God bless having this long, beautiful life.
Exactly.
But I wish we could say that in my lifetime, lifetime of my children, that we would get to a point where this type of peace she prays for happens. But it's hard to look at the events of the world today and say it's going to happen.
I have been seeing videos of young boys being trained to use guns, boys 6, 7, 8, 9 years old in countries where they are trained to be fighters, where they are trained to attack. I mean, is this going on in just one part of the world, Shane?
No, I think it's probably, there's a culture of violence in many places. I mean, we have a culture of violence in this country, and
exactly.
I'm not trying to draw false parallels here. But, I think it is in human nature to, this is why we call winning the peace. We are somehow predisposed as human beings towards conflict. And I know that's a grand statement, but I think that it is backed up by what you're seeing on display in the world right now. And I mean, we talked about the Second World War. There are many ways where the state of the world doesn't look all that different fundamentally at the root. And maybe, it's a sad commentary, but maybe this is who we are, and that actually winning the peace is something to strive for that is rare.
Can I make an optimistic comment, which is in response to what that wonderful 87-year-old lady said, that if you look at the numbers, deaths from wars are actually drastically lower today than they were all through the 20th century. The actual statistical trends are down. What we see in the palm of our hands and on our screens gives us a different impression. It jars with that because we're so much more able to see it. But your chances of dying in a war or dying from a disease or dying young are far, far lower today than they were 30, 50, 70 years ago. And I think that trend should be borne in mind amidst all the gloom.
All right. We'll keep that in mind, try to keep it in mind as we look at what's happening in the world. Ed Luce, chief U.S. columnist and commentator for the Financial Times, author of Time to Start Thinking, America and the Specter of Decline. Shane Harris is senior correspondent with The Daily Beast. Yogi Driessen, managing editor of Foreign Policy. Thank you all.
Thanks, Diane.
And thanks for listening all. Have a great weekend. I'm Diane Rehm.